Keeneland Life's Work Project. Number 6. Dr. Gary Lavin. As Will Rogers said, the best doctors in the world are the veterinarians, because their patients can't talk.
Very, very true, but at the same time, they don't lie to you either, so that gives us an advantage right there.
His long intimacy with the physical structure of the thoroughbred has taught Lavin to marvel, above all, at those intangibles housed within. Instructively, in fact, this doyen of racetrack veterinarians has observed a correlation between their performance as athlete and as patient. Ruffian, sadly, was an exception. Otherwise, however, Lavin has found that the better the horse, the easier he or she will be to manage.
Particularly even under anesthesia, their pulse and respiration were all just textbook. And that's not always the case.
In the 100th running of the Kentucky Derby, the roughhouse contested by 23 starters in 1974, the outsider, Flip Sal, broke down in the back stretch.
When I got over there to him, he was over there in that spot where they take horses that they're going to euthanize. And so I got there, and he was still standing, had the leg held up, though, and obviously it was an ankle. That was the same thing that had done Ruffian in. And he seemed, he wasn't pawing or doing, he's just standing there with it. And I suggested that, you know, the hospital was just off of the racetrack. It was still racetrack property, but there was an isolated barn across the street, an L-shaped barn. And I had the surgery facility in the short end. Not that I intended for surgery or anything, but I suggested that we just take him over there, see how he would cool out, and we'd go from there.
Lavin and his esteemed colleague, Dr. Robert Copeland, found the horse still composed and quiet the next morning.
He was still doing good. He had a good pulse in his pastern. And we decided, well, we'll just see what happens. And we snugged him up in a tight bandage. And day by day, and finally we put a cast on him, and he was all right. Anyway, he spent the entire summer there. And, of course, Dr. Copeland and I get all the credits, you know, for doing such a wonderful job. All we did was feed him and clean the stall and change the cast, you know, whenever we thought he needed it. That horse saved himself is what happened.
Maybe so. Though perhaps Lavin's characteristic modesty contributes to this assessment. This, after all, is a man whose work with the racehorse, from claimers to champions for over 3 decades as racetrack vet, is measured by an alphabet soup, spelling out his peers' esteem, past president of the American Association of Equine Practitioners and the Kentucky Thoroughbred Association, winner of the Bellwether Medal for Distinguished Leadership from the University of Pennsylvania, steward of the Jockey Club, trustee of the TOBA and the Breeders' Cup, director of Keeneland, vice chairman of the Grayson Foundation, etc., etc. So here's a man who has long put the practical into the practitioner, trusted by elite horsemen to maintain that fragile margin where their dreams meet sinew, bone, and ligament. He was born among them, after all, a racetrack brat. Though his family has Kentucky roots and his grandfather was a doctor, the medical and bluegrass strands only became entwined when Lavin, himself born in New Orleans, raised in Arkansas and trained in Pennsylvania, cut his teeth after qualifying in 1962 by sitting in with Dr. William R. McGee of Haggard Davidson and McGee. The idea was to learn about broodmares. The racetrack young Lavin knew about. His father, an assistant trainer for Greentree in California before the war, had then dug bullets out of the mules coming off the Burma Trail, before working his way from gate crew to racing secretary at Keeneland, and then to similar appointments from Churchill to Oaklawn to Hot Springs to Delaware.
He was very good at the job and had an awful, awful, awful lot of contacts and knew everybody. He was that kind of person and I think was well-liked and, of course, very successful. And having grown up in that atmosphere, I knew more than a little something, maybe not as much as I thought I did, but I knew a whole lot about the front side, too, and how all that worked.
By now married to Betsy, Lavin bought a 40-acre plot adjacent to Hermitage and was hired by his neighbour, Warner L. Jones, as farm vet. True, while their own Longfield farm would expand in size and importance until ultimately producing consecutive Preakness winners, the Hermitage position didn't last very long. This was 1964, the early days of palpating, and for some reason the mares were struggling to conceive.
And the farm manager, old cruddy, good Skippy old Napier, never forget him, of course. Everybody called him Skippy, but there wasn't much Skippy about him. He was a hard-nosed old Hermitage farm, you know, was laid out pretty much like an army base. And he decided that it was the palpating that was the reason we weren't getting any mares in the foals.
Jones summoned Lavin and announced that the previous vet would be coming back to resume responsibility for the mares. Well, that wasn't going to leave Lavin a lot, except the youngsters and indignity.
For some reason, deep down in me somewhere, I got the courage enough to say, Mr. Jones, I said, if that be the case, why don't you just let Dr. Cochran have the rest of it and I'll just go my way. But as it turned out, having lost him as a client, we became partners in almost everything you can do in the horse business before it was all over. He was a street fighter, certainly, but had the talents that he could just charm almost anybody.
As so often in life, an apparent step back launched two steps forward. Growing up around the track, Lavin had admired the veterinarians who could work for any barn, but were beholden to none. And it so happened that he returned to that environment at a time when science was transforming his professional possibilities, above all, thanks to more effective tranquilizers.
When I got to Churchill, surgery was in its very, very beginnings. When I got to Penn, that was the summer that Tim Tam broke down in the Belmont. And he went to the University of Pennsylvania for his surgery. I've always kind of marked that as the time when it made the front page of the Racing Farm for days or weeks after that, that it put it kind of in, you know, people knew that it was possible.
Or take the flexible endoscope. When Lavin qualified, they were still using a rigid scope.
Along with the fact that you really can't trust the tranquilizer at that time, you had to have a very, very good reason, or you had to be very, very brave to insert that 3-foot stick up through a horse's head. It's a different world.
Mind you, they would still dispense veterinary prescriptions at Wagner's drugstore round the corner. With limited literacy among the backstretched staff, the recipes would be numbered.
Dr. Young's number 4 was for colic. Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons' number 7 was a working paint, and on and on and on.
Some treatments, however, were rather more contentious, especially, Lavin found, those introduced by out-of-town horsemen, almost invariably in a brown paper bag. Lavin would put them in the trunk, pull up somewhere, and throw them into the trash. When Canonero arrived from Venezuela in 1971, one of his crew who could speak a little English approached Lavin on Derby morning and asked what might he legally use to put a horse on his toes.
You know, in those days, the rules were very simple. You didn't use narcotics, of course, and you couldn't use depressants or stimulants or anything, actually, that would interfere with the testing. So that, of course, opened up to all the steroids and things, which were fairly new at the time. And so I told him, I said, on this particular day, Derby Day, I said, you don't need anything like that. The Canonero will be perfectly fine.
In the event, of course, Cannonero was more than fine and exploded past 17 horses to win going away. But the story reflects Lavin's vexation with a misplaced faith among some horsemen in medication as some kind of occult, transformative box of tricks.
Lasix is the one everybody loves to talk about. I hate to talk about it, but I will. You know, it's a performance-enhancing drug. It's a debilitating drug. Dehydrates and all these terrible things that can happen with it. And in the same breath, I will tell you, yes, that's the very same thing that your grandmother in her wheelchair takes every morning. Now, you tell me that this is a dangerous drug. It's innocuous. The worst thing about Lasix is that it is so innocuous, you can make up any story you want. Some people are going to believe it. There was a statistic just the other day about the number of horses that... the number of stakes winners that actually won a stake last year that did not race on Lasix. And of the 408 stakes or something, I think there were 11 of them or 5 of them. It was ridiculous. And what a waste of money. And of course, I'm enough of an old fogey. We didn't have Lasix when I was getting started. We were into the 90s before a horse won a Derby racing on Lasix. So, you know, what's the big deal? But trainers, as a lot, you know, if that trainer across the street or the one on the backside of your barn was winning more races than you are, and he was adding a little peanut butter and jelly to his evening meal, do I have to tell you the rest of it, huh? You'd sell a whole lot of peanut butter and jelly on the backside.
For better or worse, times have changed. Think back to Flip Sal himself and the assets he was able to offer when salvaged for a stud career. To whatever extent his redemption should be credited to his doctors, you won't find many nowadays who have made 24 starts by the May of their three-year-old careers. Lavin likes to remind people that Seabiscuit ran 35 times as a two-year-old. And some years, though he was working at the track at least 300 days, he didn't have to destroy a single horse. On the other hand, the lower mileage of the modern era, Lavin attributes not so much to the horse as to trainers.
If anything, we are growing a stronger horse simply because they're not wormy. You know, you keep the worms out of them, and everything they're eating goes into making them not necessarily bigger. I would bet that, you know, a little bit, they're a little bigger probably than when I started, just a little. Certainly, they're stronger.
But fortitude, in horses no less than in people, is not just a matter of physical reserves. Having been at such pains to deprecate his role in the redemption of Flip Sal, it comes as no surprise to hear Lavin share a story that vividly sustains what we might call the Will Rogers principle. One Saturday afternoon, he took a call from a small farm where a client took exemplary care of his riding horses.
Doc, this horse, he's just not quite feeling right. I think he's a little uncomfortable. He says, my wife and I are going out for the evening, and I just feel a lot better if you just take a look at him, and I'll feel better while I'm gone.
As far as Lavin recalls, the most he might have done was administer a small shot of tranquilizer. Essentially, there didn't seem to be a thing wrong with him. Next morning, the phone rang again.
Doc, I got to tell you something. I said, what is that, Don? He said, we came home last night, and this horse was dead. Well, how about that? Anyway, I went by there on my way home that late that morning, being a Sunday, and the horse was he was dead. That was good diagnosis. But he was in that stall, and there wasn't a blade, not one bit of straw out of sorts. Nothing messed up in the stall at all. You know, how could this happen? So we sent him up to the university for an autopsy to find out. Sure enough, he had died from the cut. He had ruptured his stomach. Now, on a short list of the worst things you could wish on a horse, a ruptured stomach would be one of them. this horse didn't so much as dig a little place in the floor.
And if a horse can be judged only by this inscrutable veneer, then horsemen must beware of pushing for answers. Much of the time, in fact, Lavin feels you can trust them to train themselves. He compares an experienced racehorse to the football player who doesn't feel on song when getting up in the morning, but who still runs out onto the field and just manages his game. As Lavin tells his son, who works in insurance, a horse with a bowed tendon tends to be a secure policy because it will always train and race inside the limit. As such, he's always wary of inflexible protocols.
Because if you keep looking, you're going to find things, particularly in the older horse.
One of his cherished clients, four-time Indy 500 winner A.J. Foyt, once made a resonant remark about his own brand of horsepower. Asked by Lavin how his vehicle was going, he replied,
"Well, he says at 210 it's going okay, but at 2 and 11 now, at 2 and 11 there's a little bit of a rumble."
Another time, Foyt observed a surgery on one of his horses. As he was sewing up, Lavin remarked on the similarities between their work in terms of keeping the conveyance going.
"But there's one big, big difference between my patient and your patient." He said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "What's that?" I said, "We don't have any spare parts."
Any true horseman, as such, will feel an affinity with Lavin, because he absolutely shares the same fixation with the racehorse, has always known that maximising its well-being will also maximise its potential. That's not just a matter of his professional tool bag. It's the full spectrum, from choosing the right matings to the state of the tack room. As Lavin likes to say, not least after working so long with D. Wayne Lucas,
"There's more to horse training than training horses."
For over 30 years, he was in daily contact with racetrack paragons on two legs and four. He remembers an audience with Secretariat himself one morning at Churchill. Eddie Swaite walking the champ up and down and then standing him up. The awed silence, finally broken only when his groom said,
"Isn't he the grandest looking horse you ever saw?" And I said, "No." And he looked at me like, you know, he didn't turn loose of the horse, but he wished he could. I said, "No." And he said, "Well, now who did? Who is?" And I didn't blink an eye or anything. I just said, "Majestic Prince." That stopped him. And of course, the reason being, Secretariat was such a different kind of horse from Majestic Prince. If you took those two pictures side by side and had a horseman pick the one they'd like to have, I'd love to know where it would finish. If you said, I want a horse that'll run 3/4, 7/8 of a mile, they will all say Secretariat. But if I want a two-turn horse, you know, it'd be Majestic Prince. So there you are.
No rules, then. Lavin, of course, reveres both horses as all-time greats. He's purely remarking on the difference in phenotype, characterising Secretariat as the equivalent of a tight end and Majestic Prince as wide receiver. No rules and fewer shortcuts. Forgo had the worst-looking legs Lavin ever saw on a horse, and he reckons that if you conduct 200 cardiograms, at best you might find a couple you wouldn't want. But he also knows that if you get things right, you do improve the odds. He knows that because he himself raised back-to-back Preakness winners, Pine Bluff and Prairie Bayou. For the little parcel of land by Hermitage Farm expanded at one point to as many as 700 acres, and between Borders and their own Longfield Farm band to 100 mares. Prairie Bayou certainly showed there are no rules. His pedigree was so mediocre that they had him castrated while he was being broken in Ocala. Another of Lavin's patients, Sea Hero, beat him with a cleaner trip in the Derby, but missed the board at Pimlico. As such, Prairie Bayou only had to finish the Belmont to get a seven-figure bonus for bossing the series. Tragically, however, finish he didn't. The silver lining to his loss was that Paul Mellon, Sea Hero's owner, presented the bonus to the Grayson Foundation, an institution Lavin is proud to count among the many he has served pro bono. Pine Bluff's story also had a gratifying sequel. His dam delivered a full sister, who was, however, badly crooked in front. She was trained only with a view to establishing her potential merit as a guide to the level of covering she warranted. Sure enough, she cruised home in her maiden, but broke down when trying for a stake on her second start. At the loblolly dispersal, Lavin confided to Arthur Hancock that she was the most talented animal the stable ever had. Hancock paid $525,000 and bred her to Mr. Prospector. In 1998, Lavin went to Stone Farm as part of the Keeneland inspection team. A couple of years previously, he had quit the track practice, tired out by 33 years on the backside. It was a refreshing change, and this was to prove its most rewarding morning, a first meeting with Fuzaichi Pegasus.
And of course, you know what they look like in late March in Kentucky. And Arthur always, you know, raised him like Mother Nature intended. And so we went out to look at him. He and I talk about it still. And he was all slicked up. You know, he's never had a brush on him. He's ready to have his picture made. We go back that day. And we tell Jeffrey, we said, we've seen the sail topper. Before the year's over, we not only made him the sail topper, we made him the Derby winner. Walt Disney wouldn't be silly enough to make a film like that. It's just, it doesn't happen.
If they did make a movie, of course, you could hardly confine the script to the horses. You'd find yourself back in the silent era. As it is, the breed is fortunate that its mute needs should be legible to a man like this. And the whole Kentucky horse community, likewise, that he should have been cast in such a valuable role.